Welcome to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. I'm Stephen Spitz. Today we're going to get an insider's take on Cesar Chavez and the United Farm Workers from Frank Barnicky, author of the recent book, Trampling Out the Vintage. Barnicky, a Berkeley protester in the 60s, joined the UFW in 1971, cut celery in the fields, and later taught agricultural history in the off-season. Frank Barnicky, welcome to the program.
Well, glad to be here, Steve.
Frank, your book tells a really fascinating story of the rise and fall of Cesar Chavez and the United Farm Workers, but let's start with what it was like for you to work in the fields in the 70s. What exactly did you do?
Well, I did various things. I started out working with what they call El Cortito, which is the short-handled hoe. It was in 1971, and it was right after the United Farm Workers Union had won a big strike in 1970. And as part of that victory, they'd won a hiring hall. So that without any experience, you could go into the hiring hall and get dispatched to a crew. So I got dispatched to a thinning crew where they used a short-handled hoe.
So I'm sure a lot of listeners would like to know why a Berkeley grad would go to work in the fields doing what you were doing.
Well, I needed a job. I had come to this area because I was working on at a GI coffee house. I don't know if you remember those, but during the Vietnam War, people in the anti-war movement set up coffee houses near military bases. And the idea was that you could make a living selling coffee, and then you would also have an opportunity to talk to military personnel about the war in Vietnam. Many of these were very successful. There was one near Fort Hood that was very successful. There was one in Guam that was very successful. The one here at Fort Ord was not particularly successful, and so we couldn't make a living selling coffee, so we had to do other things to make a living. So I picked up a hitchhiker, and he had just been working in the fields. He'd gotten dispatched to the job from the union, so I went over and paid my union dues, and a friend of mine and I got dispatched to the fields.
So you did this for, I guess, 6 years, right?
For six seasons, yeah. And it took me six seasons to become an average farm worker. One of the big lies about farm work is that it's unskilled labor. That's simply not true. It's hard to learn. It's hard to do. It takes years and years to become good at it. One of the things about the recent negotiations over the comprehensive immigration bill is that when they're talking about this guest worker program, they put it in a category of unskilled labor. But in fact, it's not unskilled labor at all. It's extremely difficult to learn to do.
So why did you stop after six seasons?
In 1979, there was a major strike. And during the strike, because I was on strike, I got another job loading trucks in the local frozen food industry, and when people were called back to work after 18 months on strike, I decided to stay loading trucks.
All right, so let's get to the big story, which is the rise and fall of Cesar Chavez and the farm workers. And maybe you, for listeners who aren't familiar with that story, could you just start with a short synopsis?
The United Farm Workers Union started in the mid-1960s when the Bracero program ended. The Bracero program was a guest worker program, and it really couldn't have ever happened if the Bracero program had continued to exist. So they had to, once the Bracero program was over, and Braceros could no longer use to be break strikes, then there was possibility to build a farm worker union. It started in a grape strike, a table grape strike in the Central Valley of California. And the UFW, it was started by Filipino workers. Filipinos were about 30% of the table grape workforce. And the UFW, which at the time was a small community organization, decided to join the strike, even though Chavez and the people who were leading the union at the time knew that or suspected that the strike would probably lose.
And so how about a short synopsis then on Cesar Chavez himself?
Chavez is what we call puro Chicano. He was raised on a farm that was homesteaded by his grandfather in Arizona, before Arizona even was a state. His grandfather voted in a Texas election, so he was third generation in the United States. He grew up on this homesteaded farm. The farm was lost in the Depression. An Anglo lawyer paid taxes on it and took over the farm. When Cesar was 10 years old, the family was pushed into the migrant stream in California in an attempt to make enough money to pay back taxes so as not to lose the farm. and they didn't make it. As many people on the migrant stream didn't make it, they didn't make enough money to make the back taxes. And so he became a migrant farm worker at the age of 10 years old. It was a terribly abrupt end to his childhood, a childhood which on a farm, there was a fairly prosperous farm. His dad had a small grocery store, a childhood that had been quite happy, but ended, as I say, abruptly when he joined the migrant stream. He couldn't leave his toys outside because they'd be taken away. He was bullied by older boys. He was cheated at the local stores, all of that kind of stuff that happens to the migrant in the migrant stream. He left school after junior high to continue to work with his family all over California. 18 or 19 years old, he joins the Navy during the Second World War and serves in the Pacific. When he comes back after the Second World War, like many, many veterans who had worked in the fields, he doesn't go back to the fields. He instead works in a lumber yard. And when he works in a lumber yard, his wife especially has been very active in community organizations. And he, through the church, because Caesar was a very religious person, through the church becomes active in social causes. He then is recruited into an Alinsky organization by Fred Ross Sr., and that Alinsky organization called the Community Service Organization. He works there for 10 years under the direction and leadership of Alinsky and Fred Ross, and they build the Community Service Organization into a very successful Mexican-American organization. He then leaves that to build the United Farm Workers Union.
One of the things I wanted to ask you was a lot of people saw organizing farm workers as an impossibility. Chavez didn't. And I'm wondering if you have a theory on why this person happened to see a possibility where almost everyone else saw it as an impossibility.
Well, it was very difficult. There is, within the farm worker tradition, there have been a tremendous amount of struggle. It isn't that nobody ever attempted to form farm labor unions before. In the 1930s, there was tremendous struggle in the fields. And the struggle sometimes raised wages, but people were never able to build a union. When the Bracero program ended, Chavez, towards the last years of the Bracero program, Chavez wasn't the only person who could see that when the Bracero program actually ends, there was going to be a possibility. Because the Braceros were getting more and more difficult to control. There was more and more of a movement in the country to get rid of the program. And many people, many experts thought, well, you know what, there's a possibility for unionization after the Bracero program.
Yeah, and the Braceros were essentially a guest worker program and who worked at a lower wage than American citizens would work for.
Exactly correct. It's just the same kind of thing they're trying to set up today. So Chavez wanted to try to organize farm workers. Now, the organization he was working with, Community Service Organization, didn't want to do it. So that's part of the story. He wasn't the only person. There was AWOC was around. There were other people who were trying to do it. But there is something to your question, and that is that Chavez had a very deep belief in his own ability to get people together. And he firmly believed that if you could get people together, you could do almost anything. In that sense, he was a very political person. So he had this belief that enough people together, you could do almost anything. And secondly, he had his faith. He really did think he was on, you know, God was on his side. And he believed that social justice was a part of the great design, that people would eventually get social justice. So he had those two things. And plus, the times were pointed towards the possibilities of building a farm worker union.
So let me just mention, if you've just tuned in, this is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My name is Stephen Spitz, and today we're very pleased to have on the phone Frank Bardicke, who's written a book called Trampling Out the Vintage. It's about the rise and fall of Cesar Chavez and the United Farm Workers. And you mentioned, I have to just ask you about Alinsky, Saul Alinsky, because those of us that followed the campaign last year heard a lot from Newt Gingrich about Saul Alinsky trying to connect him to Obama, which was kind of a difficult connection since Alinsky died in 72 and Obama did his organization in 85. But there is, as you say, a real connection with Cesar Chavez and the community service organizations and then how he tries to organize the farm workers. And I wonder if you can just talk a little bit about how Chavez used what he learned about organization to try to organize the farm workers.
Yeah, I think that Chavez has two intellectual mentors. One is Alinsky, and the other is Catholic Social Action, the whole tradition of Catholic Social Action. And what he got from Alinsky were a couple of things. One was, well, this belief in politics, number one. And secondly, a notion of the central role of the organizer, that a good organizer could take a community that was disunited, take a community that was defeated and apathetic, and through political skill, bring the leaders of that community together and forge them into a fighting organization. And you did this by picking issues that could easily be won at first and which united the disparate elements in the community. And then if you won a few easy victories at first that united people, people would see that united that they were more powerful than they were separate, and that you could build a fighting organization. And that was his outlook, and that sort of motivated him to build kind of a community organization, or to try to build a union using the techniques of building a community organization in the early years.
See, it seems like you can't emphasize enough how difficult a task this was.
To a large extent, the early victories, of course, are not won in the fields. Because, you know, in that description of the strike, the table grape strike was, in fact, lost. They did not win the table grape strike. It was like many farm worker strikes in 1965. It was like many farm worker strikes. The bosses upped the wages but refused to recognize the union.
You know, this was typical, right? There'd be a local labor action. There'd be some dealing with what the complaint was. The wages would go up. And then the next year you'd have to fight again.
Exactly right. And what Chavez understood before going into the strike was that it was 1965, and that the model that the Southern Civil Rights Movement had used of mobilizing Northern support, Northern liberal support, in support of the fight against segregation in the South could be a very powerful tool, and that with Northern liberal support, they could win things in the South that they couldn't win as long as the battle was fought just in the South. And Chavez, in these meetings, where the what became the United Farm Workers Union, where they were talking about whether or not they should join the Filipino strike. The Filipinos started the strike in 1965. Whether we should join it, Chavez would say, he said he made two arguments. The first argument was, we have to join the Filipino strike because if we scab against the Filipinos, we're not going to be able to build anything here for the next decade. We have to join it. This is very symbolic that the very first UFW strike was a strike where Mexican solidarity with a Filipino strike. This is sort of unusual in California history. In California history, usually you have one ethnic group scabbing against another. This was a case where one ethnic group went out in solidarity with another ethnic group. That was the first thing he argued. The second thing he argued was, if we lose this strike, which we probably will, let's figure out some way to leverage support from the Northern liberal community for our strike here in Delano, just like the African Americans have done. He didn't say African Americans, he said Negroes, because that was the word that was used in the time.
And he comes up with it, and it's sort of a brilliant idea, because you know, farm workers aren't part of the National Labor Relations Act, so they're
right.
Not bound by the provision that says you can't have a secondary boycott.
Right.
And he comes up with the idea of a secondary boycott, and then he also becomes the perfect figure to lead that secondary boycott, does he not?
Yep. And, you know, now if we see a failed local movement, one of the first things we think of is a boycott. It's become standard fare. But back in 1965, it wasn't standard fare. The reason we think of it is because of their victory back then, followed by people mimicking it ever since. But in 65, a boycott, it was like a don't buy page on the back of a union newspaper that nobody reads.
And people now tend to think of it as easy, but there were tremendous barriers to this too, racial, cultural, linguistic,
absolutely.
Economic. I mean, it's almost mind-boggling that they were able to pull this off.
Absolutely. And it took them 5 years. 5 years doesn't sound very long to us now because we know they won. But it was 5 years they didn't know they were going to win. And one of the other genius things that they did was not only to move into the boycott, but to actually send farm workers out to major American cities to live there. You know, a lot of people like in the 1920s and 1930s, if they had a local struggle, they would go on a tour through New York or through Chicago or something like that and hold a rally and talk to people, but then go home. But what the UFW did was send people to actually live in Philadelphia, live in Chicago, live in New York City, live in Washington. And farm workers who had never been out of the Central Valley, the only other places they'd ever been was Mexico and the Central Valley, who didn't speak English at a time when the Latino community in the United States was not spread throughout the United States. And these folks, because of their dedication to the union, and to a large extent because of their beliefs in Cesar Chavez, went and lived for 5 years in these communities and built this boycott. So that the strike lost, but the boycott was so successful that the growers couldn't sell their grapes, so they had to sign union contracts.
Yeah, it's amazing to me, because even figuring out where the grapes went wasn't very easy, right? How did they figure out where the scab grapes were going?
Well, they followed the trucks and followed the trains. They physically followed them. They learned in the struggle how the stuff was distributed, and they were very creative about it. And it wasn't something that they clearly decided to do. There's something that they discovered in the process. They didn't decide to do it beforehand. What they had decided to do was to try to leverage support in the cities for their local rural strike. But they didn't know how. They didn't say, let's do a boycott. What happened was they followed some scab grapes. They followed them to San Francisco. This was the very beginning of the boycott. They followed them to San Francisco, and they were being loaded on a ship. And they got out of their car with a couple of handmade signs, three or four people, and said, don't eat grapes. And the longshoremen in San Francisco refused to handle the grapes. And that was the beginning of the boycott. And it was from that they learned. Then they went to the wholesale markets in Los Angeles. And some workers at the wholesale markets refused to handle the grapes. And as you say, since they weren't covered by the NLRB, such a secondary boycott was legal.
Well, let me just mention, if you've just tuned in, this is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My name is Stephen Spitz, and we're very pleased to be talking with the author of Trampling Out the Vintage, which is the rise and fall of the UFW and Cesar Chavez, and that author is Frank Barnicky. And Frank, I think Chavez was a perfect person to lead this boycott, and part of it was something you alluded to earlier, which was his Catholic take on all this, and I can't remember the quote exactly, but he says something like, the highest goal one can have is suffering for someone else. And he would visibly suffer. He went on these fasts, and he emphasized the nonviolent nature, what he claimed to be the nonviolent nature of these strikes, and he became an American icon in doing this.
Yeah, this gets into a bit of a complication, Steve, because he did do that, and he built, just as you say, he emphasized suffering and he emphasized nonviolence. Remember, when he went on his fast for nonviolence in 1968 is one of the most violent years in American history. And here you have this modest farm worker on a fast for nonviolence in the middle of those years.
And a Mexican-American. People weren't familiar with Mexican-Americans.
Yes, right. And it was just power. And with a very simple, with a very simple thing that people could do. Don't buy grapes. Support us by don't buying grapes. Meanwhile, there's rolling thunder over Vietnam. More bombs are being dropped on Vietnam than are dropped in all of Europe in the Second World War. The cities are burning. It was an extremely, extremely popular appeal. But now what happened? Every cloud has a silver lining. Every silver lining has a cloud. Is that he got so much into the boycott and organizing the boycott, and he was so much represented sort of farm workers as poor, suffering people reaching out to you for help, that they got distracted from doing the actual organizing in the fields. And there were a lot of people in the fields who weren't all that interested in sacrifice. They were working real hard for not that much money. And they weren't interested in more sacrifice. They wanted some benefits. And what happened was that the boycott, which had been successful and led to their first victories, became more important than organizing farm workers themselves. And so the boycott tail wagged the farm worker dog. And Chavez himself and the organization following him gets more interested in the sort of Democratic Party politics and the politics of organizing support than they do of what's actually happening in the fields.
And the sort of scenario that you hear is that Chavez and the UFW were on the verge of success or near success and then kind of imploded because of this emphasis on boycotting instead of on local issues and on organizing workers in the field. But I just wonder if that sort of overstates the power of the UFW at its height and understates the power of agribusiness. I mean, at the height of the organization, as I understand it, the UFW only had about 40 or 50,000 people in the union out of maybe 250,000 farm workers. So is it really fair to say that they were on the verge of success?
Well, they had their foot in the door. Maybe they had their foot in their door and their shoulder and their hip also. They only had about a little less than, in the industry they were working in, which is fresh fruits, they had about a little less than half the industry. And you're absolutely right that they were either going to have to expand or they were going to die because it costs more to have a UFW contract. It's a very competitive industry, and the union companies couldn't hold out against non-union companies who paid less for their labor, paid less in benefits, who had less control over their workforce than the UFW had. So, and yes, the California agribusiness is very powerful and has all kinds of friends in high places and also all kinds of ways to shift the work around in order to avoid UFW contracts. One of the major things they did was to bring back the farm labor contractors. Yes to all of that, Steve. And yes, when they fail, when they get defeated, is the 1980s. They get defeated in the 1980s. Well, what are the 1980s is all about? Beating unions, not only unions in the fields, but unions all over the place. Yes to all of that. On the other hand, they had at one time a group of very militant, rank-and-file farm workers who were well-entrenched in the basic fresh vegetable industry in California, who were anxious to spread the union. And the local leadership of the union, got in an internal fight with the top leadership of the union. So it was the local leaders versus the top leaders. And that internal fight happened in the late 70s and early 80s, and it was a fight over how much energy should be put into organizing farm workers and how much energy should be put into sort of working with the Democratic Party and in politics. And the local leadership lost that fight. Chavez won it, as, you know, most of these fights, that's the way it happens. The top leadership wins them, the local leaders lose them. And that fight debilitated the union so that when the growers moved against the union in the early 80s, their union was in no position to fight back. Now, would they have been able to win if that internal fight hadn't happened? It's impossible to say. You can't really do history like that. We can't say, but we can say with great confidence that they would have put up a hell of a fight. As it was, they put up no fight. They just rolled over and died. And almost overnight, in between like 1983 and 1984, right around those years, the union was defeated in the fields. Farm wages dropped 30% to 40%, and conditions reverted back to, in some cases, as bad as they'd been before the UFW ever existed.
One of the reasons that it's attributed to the failure was the UFW's and Chavez's initial hostility toward people they called illegals, the undocumented.
Yes.
And that they sort of the composition of the labor market changed. It went from very few, quote, illegals to maybe 50% of farm workers being illegals by the 80s. And the reason I mention this is I want to come back to something you raised earlier, which is the comprehensive immigration reform point and the guest worker program. Because right now, of course, the Farm Workers Union still exists. It's a big supporter of the undocumented. The unions tend to oppose any guest worker program. Republicans right now are insisting on it as a condition of comprehensive immigration reform. They want 25,000 to 30,000 guest workers to be able to come in a year. And I guess I have two questions for you. One is, do we need a guest worker program at all? And two, do we need it now when there's such high unemployment and such long-term high unemployment?
Well, the big questions. And let me just say something about your summary, which is extremely accurate. It sounds like you've read my book.
I did read your book.
Yeah, there you go. The undocumented. The UFW had a position against the undocumented, who they called illegals at the time. And that position did play a large part in doing them in, because during the period in which the UFW was organizing, California went from having a majority of legal workers to having certainly a majority of people without documents. And the fact that the UFW had been against people without documents really worked against them. So I agree with, I definitely agree with that. Now, the question of whether we need a guest worker program is, it's very interesting. I mean, growers around here, where I live, right in the midst of one of the queen cities of agribusiness, Salinas, complain about a worker shortage. They don't have enough workers, partially because the border has been made more secure. It's more difficult to cross the border. It's still possible, but it costs you a lot more money to get across if you want to come across illegally. So they don't have enough workers. Well, one of the things, the standard things, if you don't have enough workers, one of the standard things that people do in market economies, if you don't have enough of something, you pay more money for it. So one of the things that they could try before they go to a guest worker program is raising wages. The entry wage in the fields right now is the minimum wage. And back in the day, in the 1970s, it was 2.5 times. When the UFW was strong, it was 2.5 times the minimum wage. Farm work is difficult. It's very hard to do. It's very hard to learn. But if they were paying 2.5 times the minimum wage, I'll bet you they're going to find a hell of a lot more people would be willing to do it. So one thing they could do would be to raise wages. And if they raised wages, if they raised them enough, they wouldn't have a shortage of workers. Now, secondly, there's this question of the UFW is supporting a guest worker program. So is the SEIU. So is the Food and Commercial Workers Union, all people who have contracts in the fields. And currently, they're negotiating, which I think is a mistake, but they feel that if they can get union members from guest workers and that they can win in negotiations with the Chamber of Commerce and with the Farm Bureau, conditions for guest workers will not be all that bad as they were in the Becerra program. But in the negotiations, there just was a report the other day, Steve, it was really interesting, that the negotiations over the guest worker program between the unions and between the Chamber of Commerce were breaking down because the Chamber of Commerce and the Farm Bureau say the guest workers should be paid minimum wage. And the unions are saying, no, they should get more than minimum wage. One of the arguments that the Farm Bureau and the Chamber of Commerce is making for why the guest workers should get only minimum wage is because the workers who are already here are only getting minimum wage. It wouldn't be fair if the new workers made more than the U.S. citizens who are workers here. So what the guest worker program would do is what it would lock in that farm workers only make minimum wage.
And that's the whole point, right?
The whole point
is to keep wages low.
Is to keep wages low. That's the purpose of such programs. So no, I'm not. Before there's any guest worker program, let's have the entry wage in the fields be 2 times the minimum wage.
Frank, I'm afraid we're out of time. I would like to thank my guest so much today, Frank Barnicky. Frank is the author of a recent book called Trampling Out the Vintage. It's all about the rise and fall of Cesar Chavez and the UFW. I would also like to thank my producer, Joe Green. You've been listening to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas on KUNM. My name is Stephen Spitz. Podcasts of this show are available on iTunes. Search for Stephen Spitz. Archives of all my shows are available at stephenspitz.com. Thanks for listening. See you next time.